One, two, three, four.
It's said that people never die until the last person says their name. In memory of the writer and director, Paul Auster, who passed away this week, we're sharing this conversation we had back in 2017 after the publication of his novel, 4321. Auster reflects on his body of work, life, and creative process. Paul Auster was the best-selling author of Winter Journal, Sunset Park, Invisible, The Book of Illusions, and the New York Trilogy, among many other works. He was awarded the Prince of Asturias Award for Literature, the Prix Medici Etranger, an Independent Spirit Award, and the Premio Napoli. He was a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and a Commander de l'Ordre des Arts et des Lettres. He also wrote several screenplays for films such as Smoke, Lulu on the Bridge, and The Inner Life of Martin Frost, which he also directed. We apologize for the quality of the recording, since it was not originally meant to be aired as a podcast. Starting with 4321, it's like the culmination of a lifetime of work.
A culmination? I'm not sure if it's a culmination. It's certainly a large book, and it's the last thing I've written, but I certainly hope it's not the final work.
Oh, yes.
I will be doing. I have other projects going on, so it's very large, but at the same time, it didn't take me as long to write it as I thought it would. So essentially about 3.5 years. And I spent that much time on other much shorter books. So it turned out to be just one project among many in this long journey that I've been on.
But also how it's four lives, which I guess I don't want to give away things, become three, become others. Why this particular structure?
I don't know. I think it occurred to me, and it seemed fascinating. It seemed to be a way to talk about the possibilities of the life in a new way, as far as I could tell. And so as the book is structured in the following way, it's the story of one person's early life, say birth to early 20s. And there are four parallel versions of that life. And the chapters are set up in a kind of rotation. So we have chapter headings, such as 1.1, and then the next chapter would be 1.2, and that would be the second version of my character, 1.3, and then 1.4, and then it turns over again, and then it's 2.1, 2.2, et cetera, all the way through seven cycles. And that's how the book is structured. So in effect, you're reading four stories simultaneously or in rotation. And I suppose it can be destabilizing for some readers, but I feel that once you get the hang of it, it's not very difficult at all to follow, because the chapters are fairly long, roughly 40 or 50 pages of fairly small print, so that you're really inside the narrative, and then something happens, that chapter ends, and then boom, you go back to someone you've already encountered before. It's really not very difficult.
I would be curious to see the notebooks and your plots structure.
Well, I know, yes, it was all written out by hand, as I do with all of my books. And I remember that there are 8 notebooks, and that they contain the entire text of the book, because the pages are big and I write fairly small. And just to talk about method a little bit, I seem to have a predilection for notebooks with lines, you know, squares, little graph paper-like pages. And I seem to find the best notebooks come from France. So I tend to buy Clairefontaine, which is a brand I'm sure you're familiar with. And every time I'm in France, or not in France, but ask a friend to get more notebooks for me. So I tend to use those. But over the years, I've used notebooks manufactured in the United States and in Germany and in other countries. So in Norway, I remember I had some Norwegian notebooks for a while. But the French are the ones that I like the best. So all of this material, I should say, for anyone interested, is in the New York Public Library, in the Bird Collection. So nearly all my manuscripts are there. And recently being about 6 or 7 months ago, a new batch went to them, and that included all the material for 4321.
That's fascinating. I would love to be able to include images of at least one page. That I think that it's helpful for writers to see that. I love the clarity and the conciseness of your earlier work. But then you have in this these expansive sentences. And how did you find that? Was that freeing? Or?
Well, I don't know how closely you've been reading my work, but for the last 10 years or so, my sentences have changed. I think the 4 previous books to this one all are using this more expansive kind of sentence structure. Invisible, the novel, Sunset Park, the novel, and then 2 autobiographical books, Winter Journal and Interior, all use these kinds of sentences. I think it creates a kind of whirl, a kind of feeling of dancing, and there's a certain pulsion that gains by doing this. It's not as though every sentence is like that, but the rhythms are different, and they have a more accelerating quality to them than my work in the past. So for a long, long book like this, it seemed particularly helpful to be working with this kind of music to push things forward constantly.
And how does that work with your translators as well? Because, of course, you've done a lot of translation work.
You know, because the sentences are not complex so much as just long. So, I mean, you have to understand the syntax if you're a translator, but it's not terribly difficult. And then off you go.
You don't translate your own work.
No.
You need that distance and have somebody else do it.
I mean, with the French translations, French being the only language I know, foreign language that I know, I often get involved in reading through it and making comments. But then again, I'm translating to many other languages and I have no attention at all and have no idea what those translations sound like. I can only keep my fingers crossed and hope they're okay.
You did a lot of translation work. You were writing poetry. I guess part of your identity as a writer was formed in France. If you could imagine your body of work, like rooms in a house, if we could walk through some of them, starting with your poetry and translation.
Well, it starts before that. I got curious about writing when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. And so then I was writing short stories and poems. And then by the time I was in college here in New York at Columbia, I continued writing poetry. I wrote an enormous amount of prose fiction, all of it in notebooks, probably 800 to 1,000 pages of novels, I mean, attempted novels, interrupted projects, failed attempts to write longer form work, which led to such frustration on my part that I think I decided that I couldn't do it. And so I abandoned trying to write prose fiction for quite a few years and concentrated on writing poetry and also translating poetry, an activity I liked very much when I was in my early 20s. And then also, after a while, I began writing essays and articles about writers that I cared about, and publishing in various magazines. And then when I lived in France for a number of years when I was in my early and mid-20s. And then when I came back to the U.S., I tried to make my living as a translator of not poetry books, because, of course, one doesn't make a living doing that, but just prose books of all kinds. And it was a bit of a slog, but I did that for a number of years. But that was to put bread on the table. I don't consider that serious or important work. The turning point, I think, came with a crisis when I was about 30 years old. I seemed to have come to a wall with my poetry. I couldn't seem to find a way to advance. And so for a while, I wrote nothing, and I was pretty much convinced that I was finished as a writer, because I just didn't, I was lost, let's put it that way. And then, as I describe in Winter Journal, towards the end, I went to a dance rehearsal. I know it sounds like a banal thing, but that dance rehearsal turned out to be something that opened a door. You're talking about doors. A new door opened for me. And I figured out something about how I had to work in order to proceed. And the new work that emerged from that turned out to be prose. And the first piece I wrote, and this is late 1978, was a short text. It's called White Spaces. It's in my collected poems in English, probably in French somewhere, somehow. And it's about 8 pages. And I remember finishing the text at about 2 a.m. on a Saturday night in January of 1979. I worked on it over the turn of the year, and it was snowing out. I was in the country, very cold, and I went to bed at 3:30, and then the telephone rang at 7 a.m, which was a Sunday morning. Nobody calls at 7:00 a.m. on a Sunday, except with bad news, and on the phone was my uncle, telling me that my father had died unexpectedly the night before, which is so eerie to me, because just as I was coming back to life as a writer, my father was dying. Within about 10 days of his death, I started writing about him, just blindly writing about him. Eventually, that work became a book called The Invention of Solitude, and that's my first prose book. And then, I suppose, having convinced myself that it was possible for me to write prose, I revisited a lot of the old work I had done back in my 20s and discovered that there were, in fact, good things in there, the germs of good things. And out of those notebooks came City of Glass, my first novel, the first book of the New York Trilogy, and then In the Country of Last Things and the novel Moon Palace. These are all things that had been, I had been working on and thinking about, but unable to do because I was too young and too inexperienced and wasn't able to do it. I was just not capable. But later I became capable. And from then on, I've just been writing novels, essentially, with occasional autobiographical work similar to The Invention of Solitude, but no more poems. I couldn't do it anymore, and I haven't written any poems, except rather silly poems that I write for family birthdays or weddings or anniversaries, and a few times I've written lyrics for songs.
Your daughter,
Sophie. Well, not just with her, but with other people. Yeah, and that's been the story of these last however many years. So it seemed to me I had two lives as a writer. The first one as a poet, essentially, and then that ended, and then a new writer was born, and he is the writer you're talking to today.
You're not writing poetry now, although sometimes you'll continue to translate poetry, and that might appear in a book, you know, like the stories within stories.
Well, I have translated a few poems that have appeared in the novels I've written, but they're part of the story, so to speak. But I've enjoyed that. In the new book, 4321, one of the characters actually is translating when he's a student, just as I had. And so I used a few poems that I translated back when I was 20 years old. There's a poem by Paul Éluard, another one by Desnos, etc. But also he translates in the story a poem by Apollinaire, by Julie Rousse. Wonderful poem, and I did that recently while I was writing the book. A poem that I probably worked for about 2 years on, off and on. I kept revising it. I'd be, say, between chapters of 4321, when I was taking ever so slight a pause before going on, I would go back to the poem and fiddle around with it again and make changes, and I kept doing that throughout the writing of the book until I felt more or less satisfied with the result. But it was fun. And then in that recent, another recent book, Invisible, which I mentioned earlier, one of the characters translates a Homosexual poet. So that translation is in that novel. An amazingly crazy poem.
And what do you find, does it sharpen your skills? What do you get from that? Or what is the pleasure of translation?
It's just pure pleasure. I'm working with poems that are of high, high quality. There's an excellence to them that demands full attention and full effort in order to try to convey something of the greatness of the original. It's a great thing to do, and I think it's particularly a good exercise for young writers. Ezra Pound always recommended that young poets should translate, because early on, in most cases, unless you're Rimbaud or somebody like that, a precocious child, you don't really have much to say yet. But you have to learn how to be a poet, too. You have to learn how to write. And translating is a very good way to do it, because in a way, the pressure is off. You don't have to invent anything. You have to recreate something else. And in that exercise, not only are you reading at a more intense level than you would in any other circumstance, and that includes being a student and writing a paper about a poem. Actually, translating it is a far better way to understand how it works. So you're teaching yourself about literature. At the same time, you're flexing your muscles as a writer. If you're lucky and you make a good translation, you contributed something to the world.
Yeah, they also say that as well. The way to really learn something is to teach something, and that's what you're doing. You're teaching yourself.
You're teaching yourself, yes, yes.
I remember you're talking about translating the greats, you know, and then you spoke also about translating in that book things that were not so good from French into English.
Yes. And a lot of mediocre books. That was, again, it was just a job, and I was doing it for money.
But I wonder also,
however small that the money was, I was doing it for money.
I wonder also, it's best to translate the great writers, but also getting used to, because some young writers treat their work so preciously, you know, better than I do, that you have to go through just the activity of writing and just pushing things out to get the good stuff. And I don't know if that's helpful.
There are no rules. Everybody functions differently. I wouldn't tell anyone anything about how to go about this. You have to find your own way of doing it. As Goya, the great Goya, said, there are no rules in arts, and he's absolutely right. And you find your own way. So if you treat your work preciously, well, that's fine. Of course, we all treat our work as precious and work very hard at it to make it as good as we possibly can. I think translating bad books, it serves no purpose whatsoever. It's a complete waste of time in terms of teaching you anything about how to write. But I guess when you do have a bad book, you actually have to make it better in the translation than the original. So I guess there's some challenge in that. But that would be more teaching yourself how to become a good editor rather than a good writer.
I guess they're linked. As you say, there are no rules. That's what I liked about your career path as well, because it's very courageous, I feel. You opted against, you know, maybe this having the safety net of being a teacher, although I know you've done it for brief periods. But, you know, you just be a writer. It's original. It's courageous, I think. And I think that people should know that that's an option as well. I mean, now it's a lot of the MFA programs and things, but...
Yeah, I have very mixed feelings about these writing programs. I don't know if they're useful or not. I tend to think not. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think, I put it, the workshop setup is such that you write work that then is commented on by your fellow students. But what do they know? Why are their opinions more valuable than yours? I mean, it seems to me, case of the blind leading the blind. And then the teacher can be a writer whose work you like. It could be a writer whose work doesn't interest you. And again, everyone has a different approach. So I think maybe it's a kind of money generating plant by universities, but I don't know if it and the writers who are going to be good writers and continue are going to do it whether they're in a workshop or not. And the bad ones are never going to become good because of it, it seems to me.
Yeah. No, it's very interesting. And I think about also some of your other early careers. I think you were on, if you want to speak about those, the jobs you had before you became a writer.
Oh, well, I did a lot of jobs when I was young. I discovered very early that I had no interest in white-collar office jobs. I didn't want to be stuck behind a desk. So I tended to do blue-collar manual jobs, and I rather enjoyed them, I have to say. You know, I was young, I was very strong and fit, and so lifting things and hauling things wasn't difficult. And I felt that traveling in that world of people who, mostly men, but not always, mostly men without college educations, people who didn't read books, people who were not at all like me, was very helpful to help me get a feel for, you know, the rest of the world. I don't want to be with people just like myself, which is what tends to happen if you're in a university or in an office. But this was a challenge, and I suppose the most interesting job I had was when I worked as a merchant seaman on a what was then Esso, the oil company, an Esso oil tanker. And I did that for about 6 months. And there I was with a pretty rough crowd of guys. And I had to figure out a way to hold my own in that world. And I managed to do it. And there's some satisfaction in that. And I think back about those people often, and people I ran into in many different jobs. And I think the only time I've ever written about any of those people is in Hand to Mouth, that early autobiographical book, which is about not having any money and how to survive. The subtitle of Hand to Mouth is The Chronicle of Early Failure. And so I go through some of the work I did and some of the people I met along the way who tended to be fascinating. The important thing is that you're writing not for yourself. You're addressing another person or many other people. I suppose instinctively, you know, as a writer of prose fiction, of narrative, that you have to hold the reader's attention because the reader can vote very easily with his or her hands by slamming the book shut, putting it away, and never picking it up again. And I suppose your job as a writer is to sustain interest so that people will not shut the book and stop reading. I'm not talking about tricks and thrills and all kinds of exciting things, but a certain kind of conviction or tone or urgency in the writing that makes it something that you get absorbed in and don't want to leave. And that really is what all fiction writers are striving for, whether they're conscious of this or not. I mean, it's not that you're thinking about the audience because you have no idea who's going to be reading it. But you know there is somebody, if only one person, that you're in communication with. And I think this is the great force of reading novels for the reader now, as much as for the writer, is that it is a collaboration between two people, the writer and the reader. And together, they are making the book. Because each reader comes to a book with a different life, a different past, different memories, different experiences, and will interpret that book in his or her particular way. And so every book is read by different readers, so it's a different book, in a sense. And I think why the people who do like this, and I understand that most people do not read novels, or at least what we call now, it's a funny term, literary novels, as opposed to crime novels and popular novels of one sort or another. But what happens is space is created, and maybe it's the only space of its kind in the world. Two absolute strangers can meet each other on terms of absolute intimacy. I think this is what is lying at the heart of the experience and why once you become a reader, that you want to repeat that experience, that very deep internal communication with that invisible stranger who's written the book that you're holding in your hand. And that's why I think, in spite of everything, novels are not going to stop being written, no matter what the circumstances. And we need stories. All human beings need stories from the moment we're able to talk. And I don't know if you have children or not, but certainly do know about children and how hungry they are for stories to be told to them. I've never known a child who didn't want to hear a story, starting at about the age of 2, 2.5.
It reminds me of something interesting that you said about your father, that you felt closest to him when he was telling you stories, when he was telling you lies, I guess.
Yeah, well, he would make up the absurd adventure stories for me, but I was always delighted with him, I have to say.
Like you become more alive, or that he would become who he may have been, his deepest, his greatest potential, or that's how I read it.
Yes, it's quite possible. Yes. Yeah, that's a good thing to point out. So anyway, we push along. We do the best we can.
I was wondering then what you talk about parents and you talk about children, and I wonder what your children have taught you about creativity and the imagination.
Well, I don't know if we can talk about it that way. I think being a parent, especially in those early years of a child's life, it takes you back to your own childhood. You start to remember things. And that's very interesting, that you'd forgotten. And they're coming out. Your daughter, your son does something, and it can trigger off a little mental journey into a place where you hadn't visited for years. So that's very fascinating. I think, too, in my case, I felt when I became a parent, I was 30, suddenly you find yourself in a different position to your own life than you'd been before. And you see yourself not just as your parent's child, but as the parent of another child. And suddenly, you're part of a process of generations rolling along, one succeeding another. And you get a deeper sense of your own lack of permanence, that your life is going to end at some point, and your children will continue. Perhaps they will have children of their own, their children will have their children, and on it goes. And I think this feeling of the continuity of the generations, at least in my case, it made me want to tell stories rather than just write poems, which are songs, so to speak. Yeah. So they're making songs, telling stories, and somehow, and I don't understand it fully, becoming a parent seems to be wrapped up in that as well. It's about being yourself as part of a continuum of time. And, you know, I think most adolescents and young people, they think they're immortal. They're not thinking about their death. Maybe only in the most abstract ways. But then, when you have a child of your own, you know, without any doubt, you yourself are going to die. And you grow up. I mean, it's you suddenly become less selfish and less self-centered. And you begin to think of yourself as part of the movement of humanity around you.
And one thing you spoke about, you mentioned the passing of your father, I guess, when he was 66, and how that affected you and make you want to tell stories that were more essential, or, I don't know, that spoke to everyone, maybe, a wider audience. Could you speak about that a bit?
I don't know. I don't know about this audience business. I just think we never think about it because, you know, when I first started publishing poems, I was publishing in little magazines, which maybe had, I can't even guess, 200 readers, 400 readers. And then my first books were published in editions of anywhere from 500 copies to 1,000. Mm-hmm. And so the numbers were very, very small. And who knows how many people actually read these things. And with fiction, too, you know, starting out, the first four prose books I published, The Adventure of Solitude and the trilogy, were all done by little presses, with very small print money. So I was never, ever thinking about numbers. Because for me, it's only just one reader. Each time and every time, it's one reader reading your book. So whether 10 people read it or 10,000, it almost doesn't matter.
And I guess you've just been doing a lot of book tours, and I don't know if you're there with other writers or you might be on book tour or next to Siri. And can you spot the Paul Auster reader? I don't know.
Yeah, they come in all sizes and shapes. Men and women, old people and young people.
Yeah.
People in between. There's nothing that I can say about that. The only heartening thing is I've been at this for a long time now. So there are people who come to events I do who weren't even born when I started writing. Mm-hmm. And yet here they are reading my book. So that's interesting.
And also, I wanted to talk about some of your collaborations. You were talking about writing music, and of course, your writings, and you've directed films based on your writing, and your writings have been adapted into films. What do you get from that process?
Oh, I like collaborating with people. I find it very enjoyable. At various times, people have taken my work and used it for other works. For example, a theater adaptation of a novel. Or one has turned one of my books a long time ago into a great little opera. Mm-hmm. There have been dance pieces based on my work. There was a ballet based on one of my novels. I find that so interesting that one form can inspire someone working on another form to do something. But my actual own collaboration with people, writing a few songs that I did, I mean, we're talking only about a handful. It's not something I've made a practice of. But the few times I did do it, I enjoyed listening to the results. And the heaviest collaboration I've done, of course, is in movies. And that is it's a very exhausting experience to direct film, I can tell you. But it's also a very satisfying one. I love the camaraderie of all the people on the crew and the actors, and every stage of making a movie is fascinating. And I'm glad I had the chance to do this a few times. I think it taught me a lot about myself and about other people. Very important experiences, really.
And then as you came out of that process, I don't know if your voice, your writing style, I don't know what you brought out of that process into your subsequent novels.
Yeah, it had no effect whatsoever. It's two different things. Movie and a novel, they're both telling stories, but that's about the only thing they have in common.
So, baseball. Why do you write about baseball?
Oh, I love baseball, but I don't write about it that much, just a little. But it's something I came to love when I was very young. I played it. I was an ardent player and took it very seriously. And found, I suppose, my greatest happiness as a boy was playing baseball. And I find it a beautiful game, and it's continually interesting. I've watched hundreds, if not thousands, of baseball games in my life, and they're always different. There's no way to predict how things are going to turn out. And I always see something in a game that I never saw in any other game. Some bizarre or strange or unusual event takes place. And the fact of following baseball as an older person, when you get too old to play it, is that it's one of the few things in American life that is old and continuous and really hasn't changed that much since the beginning. Everything that happens in baseball is recorded. Every action has a number attached to it. And so we can look at a box score of a game played in 1915 and understand what happened in that game. You can actually see it by reading the numbers. And I would bet that among American men, anyway, a lot of more of them would know that Babe Ruth, the most famous player of all, Babe Ruth hit 60 home runs in 1927. But I'll bet you only a sliver of those men could tell you who would think it was that year. So, in a way, baseball is a way of hanging on to history as well. And it's very interesting that it's one of the few games played without a clock. So that makes it even more interesting to me.
So you really, and you find it then structurally sort of linked to novels, then they can, I don't know, go on
well,
for some.
All sporting events have a certain narrative pattern to them. I think that's why people are so interested. It's as if you're going to the theater, but you don't know what the play is going to be. You don't know whether the good guy is going to win or lose. So there's this question of suspense that I think excites people. And it certainly makes participating in sports very enjoyable. You're trying to win. The other team is trying to win. And it brings out some, how shall I put it? You do things that you didn't expect yourself to be able to do in the heat of the moment. And that's very interesting.
I'm curious about a few of your themes. Why are you fascinated with identity? You're interested not in the picture on the passport, but what's underneath this.
Yeah, I think a lot of my novels, not all of them, but a lot of them take a character in some kind of crisis. There's some situation that the character must deal with. Something new. Something has happened. Somebody has died, or there's been an accident, or there's some difficult decision that has to be made. And so I think I find it compelling to write about people in crisis, which is often a condition of transition as well, and how people cope with difficulty and how they emerge from it. And often they have to another road and start all over again in some way. So yeah, in that sense, I'm interested in the mutation of character under pressure, let's put it that way.
Right. Have you ever, I don't mean to ask a personal question, but because of series writing, have you ever been in psychoanalysis?
No, I've never been, no.
Is there something about you wouldn't want to, you want to save it for your writing, or?
I've always felt that people go to psychotherapy or psychoanalysis because they feel unhappy and there's something not right about their life then, and they need to figure out how to change it. And I've never felt so lost or so unhappy with my life that I felt I needed help from somebody else. I know from long experience, many, many people who are very close to me have profited from this immensely. So I'm not denigrating it at all. It's just I haven't ever felt the need myself.
Me too. I haven't. I think maybe it's a bit like the creative writing. Like some people benefit from it, the creative writing classes, and
yes,
others.
Possibly. Yeah. Listen, one of my very favorite writers of the 20th century, yeah. Samuel Beckett, his life was saved by psychoanalysis. Mm. I mean, if he hadn't gone in his early 20s, I don't think he would have been able to do any of the work he later did. He was in a terrible personal crisis, and his mother actually gave him the money to go to London, and for 2 years he was in a deep analysis with a very famous psychoanalyst named Bion, B-I-O-N. So it can help. It can help enormously.
So you mentioned Beckett, and I was wondering, could you speak a little bit about some of your friends and also the writers who were influential to you or who were quite important to you?
The list is so long, I don't even know where to begin. Going back. I mean, there are certain things in the Old Testament that I'm very attached to. Then there is, you know, Greek literature, particularly Homer, but then, you know, the plays and some of the poets. They're very important to me. And then there are even writers from the Middle Ages that have had a big impact on me. Augustine being one of them. Reading the Confessions of Augustine when I was 18 years old was a big, big, big experience. You know, then just sort of moving chronologically, I mean, Dante and Petrarch also hugely important. And then the Elizabethan and pre-Elizabethan era in England, it was a time when English was being formed, which is a fascinating thing. English is a new language. It was only until around 1520 that English, as we know it, was formed. And some of the early English poets, like Sir Thomas Wyatt, I don't know if you ever read Wyatt, is one of the greatest lyric poets in English history. You know, here's one. So let Hind, I know where it been Hind. Hind was a deer. But as for me, alas, I may no more. The vain travail hath wearied me so sore. I'm of them that farthest cometh behind. Yet may I, by no means my wearied eyes, draw from the deer. For as she pleadeth a boar, fainting I follow. See how beautiful it is, right?
Oh,
that was written in around 1540. And so he's, you know, two generations ahead of Shakespeare. And then we have Shakespeare, who never stops fascinating me. And he's a model for me. I know it sounds pretentious, but
I took
inspiration from Shakespeare in that he was one of those Protean artists who could work in different modes. Mm-hmm. You know, he could write tragedies and comedies and histories and lyric poems. And he was not ever satisfied with sitting still. And I felt that same kind of restless curiosity in myself. You know, there are different kinds of artists. Some people do one thing and they do it very well and they keep doing it again and again and again. And then others keep evolving. Say, it's the difference between Braque and Picasso, right?
Yes.
Braque kept doing what he had done in the beginning and it's good. Picasso kept changing, and I find Picasso finally much more interesting.
And I find your writing interesting, too, in that some people have said that you return to certain themes, but, I mean, I think this is normal, but I also see that your voice is evolving. This whole question about, it's weird, because for writers and painters is the opposite. They seem to want you to repeat yourself, have a bell formule or mm-hmm. something. It's a quality. And then sometimes when writers are identified with one thing that the critics sort of keep on seeing in their writing, they miss all the nuances and the changes.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, you know, there are the painters who, you know, for 10 years, they do blue stripes on mm-hmm. the canvas. And then suddenly the painter wakes up and he has a revelation. He says, no, blue stripes, no. Now I'm going to do orange stripes.
It's small. They're only allowed to change colors.
I mean, not too exciting.
How do you feel that technology is changing the way we communicate and interact with our imaginations? And what are your views on, you know, creativity and the importance of the humanities?
Well, that's a big question. Listen, I, for some reason, I don't know why, the stubborn old goat in me has resisted the digital world. I don't work with a computer. I don't own a computer. I don't have a mobile phone. I just haven't wanted to do email or any of those things. And well, as you know, I have a helper, and that's how you communicated with me, Jen. But I myself don't want to do this. Listen, if I had a job, I would have to participate in all this, but I don't. So I have the luxury of being able to choose. And I choose not to, really. I think, essentially, this digital revolution is a mixed phenomenon. It has its positive side and also the negative side. And I'm afraid more and more the negative side seems to be dominating. I can tell you, there's nothing more depressing for me than to say, go out for lunch in my neighborhood in Dipley, go to a little diner, you know, a little people restaurant for a sandwich, and see a family of four people or six people at the next table. Grandfather, parents, children, all three generations sitting there looking at their cell phones and not talking to one another. It kills me to look at this. And I think the smartphone has made people feel so important. They feel so much the center of the universe by holding that thing in their hands as if they own the universe. And it theoretically connects you to everybody, but I think in the end it's separating us from one another. And so I'm worried about it. And then there's the whole political side of this and, you know, the hacking and the possibility for real serious mischief. And I think I just wonder why governments can't get back to using typewriters and filing cabinets, because everything is hackable. And it used to be a spy would go in with a camera and steal one document, you know, and then put it back in the filing cabinet. But now, if you can push the right button, you can get the entire correspondence by email of, say, the State Department or the Democratic Party or whatever it is you're trying to do. Or you can hack into a company the way apparently with the North Koreans hacked into Sony. Remember?
Yeah. So,
yeah. Everyone is so vulnerable now. So,
and they're giving up these freedoms as well.
Yes, yes. And so I'm very worried about it. And I don't know what's going to happen. It seems as if there's no turning back. But we have to figure out how to use this stuff in a better way. Otherwise, we're going to really do harm to ourselves.
I think that's what's happening, yes. And that, what I feel is that the humanities are a way back, or a way to remind us, or even to time travel back to periods. You've mentioned Shakespeare, not of when life was different. It'll be a way of reminding us of our common humanity.
Yeah, if anyone is interested anymore, it's shocking how little young people know about the past. I sometimes tremble when I am confronted by this absolute ignorance about, even say, Americans not knowing anything about the American past, which is a new country with only about, you know, 300 years to talk about. It's surprising. Or meeting young people and they say, you know, old movies for a young person is something like Pulp Fiction, which came out only 20 years ago, and that for them is old. And so they ignore the whole history of movies, which again, it's a very short history, and it's very easy to master a great deal of film history in a short period of time if you make the effort to look at the films. But people are not looking back. They're looking forward. And so we'll see what happens.
Thank you very much for your time. Yeah. Thank you so much.
All right. Take good care.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk with the participation of collaborating universities and students. The associate interviews producer on this podcast is Brett Young. Digital media coordinator is Yu Young Lee. Wintertime is composed by Nicholas Anandolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. If you would like to get involved in our exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thank you for listening.